If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. When O.J. Simpson was arrested in 1994 for the murder of his ex-wife Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman, the former American football player and actor was one of the most famous men in America. The ensuing court case gripped audiences around the world, but raised troubling questions about domestic violence and racism in the United States. Following Simpson's recent death, Matt Elton spoke to Dr. Joe Street from Northumbria University, Newcastle, about the case and how we should look back on it 3 decades later.
Joe, thank you so much for being with me today on the History Extra podcast. We're talking today about a moment in the modern history of the United States and its cultural afterlife. And just to fill people in who might be unfamiliar, it's the story of O.J. Simpson, who was a former American football star turned actor, when in 1994, he was accused of the double murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman. Brown had called the police multiple times in the years beforehand, reporting physical and emotional abuse. A warrant was signed for Simpson's arrest, and he was due to hand himself into police headquarters on the 17th of June 1994, but he instead set off on a low-speed police chase through Los Angeles. The incident, which lasted around 2 hours, was broadcast live in the US and throughout the world. The ensuing court case, which spanned many months, proved equally gripping to audiences. Prosecutors argued that Simpson had killed Brown in a jealous fury, and evidence including blood and hair tests linked Simpson to the murders. The defence, meanwhile, argued that Simpson had been framed by police, motivated by racism. Simpson was eventually and controversially acquitted on the 3rd of October 1995, and in 1997, he was found liable for the 2 deaths in a civil trial. There's obviously quite a lot to unpack there, and it's obviously a subject that touches on a number of quite sensitive and quite upsetting issues. Before we get into some of those, what do people need to understand about the extent of O.J. Simpson's fame and his celebrity at the time the murders took place?
O.J. Simpson in the 1970s had been the star of college football, university football, and then became a record-setting running back for the Buffalo Bills, in which a team was kind of based around him. He broke so many records, it was almost phenomenally unbelievable. And at the same time, he also starts an acting career. He's not a particularly great actor, but he's in a number of films that are, you know, box office successes. He also appears in a series of adverts for a car rental firm. So he's kind of a pop cultural phenomenon, as well as being one of America's preeminent sportsmen. And then after his retirement, he becomes a commentator. And I think Gary Young, the journalist, wrote about him as a kind of a B-movie actor who's in decline in the 1990s. He appears in the Naked Gun series, kind of subtly satirizing himself. But he's still one of the few people in the country and in the world, you might say, who's known by his first name. You know, he's known as OJ. So it's like Madonna and Beyonce and so that. So his fame is quite incalculable. It's difficult to describe to a modern day audience how famous this man was.
So it isn't stretching it to say that he was a sort of a megastar, to use the parlance of the mid-1990s.
Oh, yes, very, very much so.
What do we need to understand about his fame to understand what happened next? Was he widely admired at this point? Was he someone who people across America would have known and felt fondness towards?
Yeah, very much so. And in the United States, sport is not quite as tribal as it is in Britain. The people will follow particular players rather than necessarily teams. So it's a little like what has happened with Lionel Messi when he goes over to the United States, that people flock to it to see Lionel Messi, that people celebrated O.J. Simpson's successes, even if they weren't necessarily a supporter of the teams that he was in, that he really was this kind of megastar, as you say, of American football.
And the fact that he was a prominent black athlete, do we need to understand aspects of that dimension of his career and his success?
Yeah, and that in itself is a topic that could inspire books, because O.J. Simpson himself said, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." And he comes about at a time, he sort of emerges in the wake of the massive fame of people like Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who are very much link their racial identity with the politics of the United States. And Simpson is one of these people who attempts to move kind of beyond that, and he kind of prefigures what Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan did, to say that he is a brand in himself.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings, that frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And this was a moment of particularly heightened racial tensions, and we'll get into some of that in a minute. Before we do, are there any other historical currents or dimensions that we need to make sense of?
I think the first thing to understand about Los Angeles is that the city itself was kind of highly segregated, in that African-American people tended to live in certain areas, whites tended to live in certain areas, and there was very little mixing. This, of course, was not just about race, it's also about class and wealth, that African-American people tend to have lower incomes, tend to be unable to buy in white areas. And in 1992, of course, we have the Rodney King incident, which is a number of LAPD officers were caught on camera beating a man, an African-American man named Rodney King, within inches of his life. They were acquitted, and it led to a series of outbreaks of violence in the inner cities, which illustrates the fact that Los Angeles is really at this, they call it a racial tinderbox in many ways. We have to understand that as well if we're to understand the Simpson trial. So it was a city that really experienced segregation, even though segregation was not formally and legally codified.
Los Angeles, as I said at the start, formed the backdrop to this extraordinary low-speed police chase, which went on for, I think, 2 hours and was covered extensively by news networks. Was this in some way something new? And does that media hype tell us something about the way in which the case was to be reported upon?
Yeah, it was new. Rolling news had been a recent phenomenon. It certainly wasn't a phenomenon over here. Because this chase took place over such a prolonged period of time, over these 2 hours, and because it was so slow, the news broadcasters were able to follow it and broadcast it live. So it has the, and people started talking to it. Have you seen what's on TV? OJ is on the loose. The juice is loose was one of the little kind of quips that went past. And also, people were lining the sides of the streets, and you would see people cheering OJ on from the bridges that he was traveling under. So meanwhile, 95 million people are watching this on television. There's rumors even the president was watching. It was then broadcast around the world, and you were able to see this kind of slow motion chase happening almost in real time. So this media furore, you might say, is central to it, because it focused people's attention on why is this man running away? Why is he doing it so slowly as well? And what is going to happen next? You know, and this is all wrapped up in O.J. Simpson's celebrity, in part because people were so invested in him as an individual that they thought he'd been accused of a crime that he didn't commit.
And by the end of the day, on the 17th of June 1994, he'd given himself up. And then the trial started to be put into place. It's interesting that you mentioned there that some people were on the streets of LA cheering this chase as it went on. And I wanted to get into a little bit the extent of his popularity or not among different groups of people in America, I suppose. How much during the trial was support for him determined along the lines of ethnicity?
It's a really interesting question, and it demands a much more complex answer than I fear I can give in a short space of time. All of the polling, though, indicates that the vast majority of white observers believed O.J. Simpson to be guilty. The vast majority of African-American observers believed him not to be guilty. But I think part of the reason for the not guilty thoughts are not just that they believed him to be innocent, but it was also that they had an instinctive understanding that the police department in Los Angeles, and indeed other police departments around the country, were brutally racist. So there was a sense that O.J. Simpson was a victim in the same way that other African-American people had been over the years. And so in that sense, believing him not to have done it is a different thing to believing him to be not guilty, if you see what I mean. And that's where I think the big division lies. It was presented at the time as a big racial division. This highlights how irreconcilable the races are in the United States. But I think in reality, there's a lot more subtlety within there about the way that African-American people in particular responded to it, that there's an instinctive distrust of the police.
These are big and complicated and quite nuanced issues. I mean, another aspect of this that we should perhaps talk about briefly is the fact that the leading defense attorney was Johnny Cochran, who was himself an African-American man. Is that something that we should think about in terms of this?
Most definitely. Cochran had made his name in cases where he was taking the LAPD to task. And in fact, one of the cases he was involved in was a case where a member of the Black Panther Party had been framed for a murder that he didn't commit, in part because he wasn't in the same city as the event on the same date. And Cochran becomes a celebrity lawyer around this time, in part because of the Simpson case. But to reduce him to a celebrity is kind of to undercut the fact that he was a very, very skillful defense attorney. He really knew the case inside out, and he knew how to push the buttons of juries and win people over. So in some respects, he becomes almost like a lightning rod during the trial itself.
We've talked already a lot about Simpson, and I don't want to overlook the fact that we are talking here around something that centres around a murder trial, a domestic violence case. Are there aspects about the victims that we should talk about that you think perhaps are overshadowed by this?
Yeah, most definitely. And it's, you know, it becomes a very, very difficult question because we kind of want to focus almost instinctively on the celebrity angle rather than on the fact that Nicole Brown Simpson was a woman who suffered domestic abuse over a long period of time and had confided to friends on a number of occasions that she feared her husband was going to kill her. In many respects, it exemplifies the fact that wealth and fame do not insulate women from domestic violence, and in fact insulate men much more. If there is a good thing to come out of the murders is the fact that the narrative about domestic violence in the United States changed in the wake of Nicole Brown's death, in that the campaigners against domestic violence were much more easily able to make direct links between domestic violence and homicide. And I think that the O.J. Simpson case brought this up into the popular culture, so it became a conversation. And the sadness really is that it takes these sort of incidents for people actually to realise the horrific impact of domestic violence.
And as the case went on, the issue of whether or not the evidence could be believed became a key aspect. Are there any parts of that side of this that we should understand?
The bloodstained gloves that Simpson was apparently wearing during the incident itself. And the case really hinges upon this moment where one of the prosecuting attorneys was basically goaded by the defense to get Simpson to try on these gloves. These are highly expensive leather gloves that he bought from Bloomingdale's. They'd been frozen and defrosted twice to preserve the evidence. And of course, during this process, the leather shrinks. And Simpson's also wearing latex gloves. He tries them on, and these shrunken gloves don't fit, which leads Cochran to kind of quip in some respects. If it don't fit, you've got to acquit. But of course, the problem is that because they didn't fit, they shouldn't have been tried on. But there's another thing beneath this, was that one of the key prosecution witnesses was an LAPD officer by the name of Mark Furman. And during the trial, it became clear that Mark Furman was very much used to using racial epithets and had boasted of tampering with evidence. Now, even though there's no evidence that he tampered with evidence during this case, the fact that he was on the stand having to admit to using these racial epithets, and also he took the Fifth Amendment to protect himself from perjury on a couple of occasions, meant that he was a fundamentally untrustworthy witness. So these two things combine to make the jury decision, while sensational as it was, not particularly surprising for anybody who'd been paying close attention.
One thing that strikes me looking back at this case from 21st century vantage point is that quips like that you've alluded to about the glove strike me certainly now as seeming tonally quite strange. Do you think that the case and the way it was reported on and the way it was handled is a product of his time, or do you think it says something wider about the United States?
That's a great question. I can only answer that by saying it's kind of both. Because court TV wasn't a thing at the time. This is the first major trial that's broadcast live across the nation. And you can sense, if you watch any of the documentary footage of it, whilst I'm here, I would say that everybody really should watch the O.J. Made in America documentary series. A wonderful piece of work that it's, you know, it says more about it in much more time than I ever could. But if you look at the footage, you can kind of sense that the judge, Lance Ito, was really, really quite enjoying the fact that he was at the center of things, that he becomes a celebrity. Similarly, that the prosecution attorneys were aware that this could make their career because they're on television every day for weeks on end. And so in that sense, it was a wholly new way of presenting trials, in that people were becoming celebrities as a consequence of their professional role. So that in itself was new. But also, I think we still have that sort of sense now that we see in the way that celebrity trials are conducted nowadays, the same sort of things happening, that people are able to make names for themselves, it plays out in the media, and in that sense, it's a real pivotal moment in you might say, American, perhaps even world history, for the way that legal trials are conducted.
And when eventually Simpson was acquitted, how much of a surprise was that? And again, was that split among certain sectors of the population?
There was widespread joy amongst the African-American population, not necessarily because people felt that he, quote-unquote, got away with it or anything like that, but more that it proved that a black man could get the white man's justice, that we have a history in the United States of white folks getting away with murders that they have committed because of all-white juries, because of the race. And here was an example of an African-American man achieving that kind of justice. So there's an awful lot of people who are quite pleased at this because in a way it proved that the LAPD were fundamentally untrustworthy, and it proved that the legal system might be geared towards white folks, but that O.J. Simpson, because of his fame and wealth, could kind of subvert it. But I don't think it signifies any wider change that the American legal system was becoming less racist. But on the other hand, there's an awful lot of white folks who I think were quite relieved, because there was a real fear that if Simpson was found guilty, that we'd have a recurrence of the outbreaks of violence that occurred in the wake of the Rodney King verdict, you know. And so in some senses, the jury may well have taken that into consideration, that they had a almost like a responsibility to kind of protect the community from itself almost. But of course, the issue then becomes that in enabling a not guilty verdict, the system continues, because it's only African-American people with the levels of wealth that O.J. Simpson had who are able to access that sort of justice. I think it also highlights how high the standard of proof have to be in a criminal trial. As you pointed out, O.J. Simpson was, on the balance of probabilities, convicted of responsibility for the murders in a civil trial. But in a criminal trial, the burden of proof is much higher.
So just to be really clear on this, in the 1997 civil trial, O.J. Simpson was found liable for the two deaths.
Yes, and in a civil trial, jurors are instructed to make the decision on the balance of probabilities, whereas in a criminal trial, it has to be beyond doubt. And what the Simpson lawyers did extremely well was say there are reasonable doubts that the LAPD tampered with this material, that the glove isn't there, you know, in which case they could have planted this glove. There's a whole host of doubts that the legal team really raised very well, which meant that it would be very, very difficult for the jury to convict.
We've talked a little bit about how one of the glimmers of positivity to come out of this horrific story was a change in attitudes towards domestic violence in the United States. And I wanted to get into some of the other longer term legacies. Are there things that we can see here that have developed on into the 21st century?
I think there are certain things that we can see, and particularly we've seen so many cases of police violence, particularly towards African American and other minorities who have essentially got away with it. And I think that the Simpson trial kind of points to this sort of thing happening, and that it is incredibly difficult for African Americans to get justice, whereas obviously Simpson's wealth insulated him to a certain extent from that. So I think it really highlights how the police and attitudes towards the police are highly racialized. That, I think, is the key thing. I think it's also worth pointing out that in the immediate wake of it, that Congress passes the Violence Against Women Act in September 1994. The passage of the Violence Against Women Act, it comes about because of Congress's horror at the murder of Nicole Simpson. And that in itself is a major act. Unfortunately, it only lasts for 6 years and has constantly been attacked by Republican politicians in the years since. So I think that there is a kind of a limited legacy of the Simpson trial in that respect.
Looking back, how can we set it within the wider context of US history?
I was pondering this. You know, in some respects, it's one of the trials of the century, you know, and legal scholars always like to talk about trials of the century. It doesn't have the political impact as, say, the Sacco and Vanzetti trial, the trial of the Rosenbergs, but it's a popular cultural phenomenon. And I think it really highlights how wealth, fame, celebrity, and race are all intertwined in the United States, particularly in the 20th century. You know, and it's kind of difficult to imagine nowadays the same sort of thing happening, in part because of our immersion in the media. But on the other hand, the Simpsons getaway chase is one of those first kind of memeable moments that you could imagine Twitter and Facebook blowing up with people watching this. So in that sense, it kind of prefigures our saturation in the media-created landscape. Whether or not, like I say, it has any wider impact beyond that is kind of difficult to say.
Finally, as a historian, what are the myths, I suppose, or oversimplifications of this story that you'd like to see corrected or changed?
I think that the big issue here is the issue about whether African Americans believe him to be guilty or not. And I think that a lot of people kind of respond to that in almost nationalistic terms. Well, they would say that because they are the same race as O.J. Simpson. And I think it really is important that we acknowledge the fact that this is not about that issue. This is a reflection of people's experience of police racism, of police brutality, particularly in the inner cities. And then it comes out of people's own knowledge of these situations, that the LAPD was tampering with evidence. It had got away with the Rodney King murders. It had got away with a number of other atrocities in the 30 years previous to the O.J. Simpson trial. And I think that the people's response to the O.J. Simpson are more a reflection of their response to law enforcement in the United States. And that, I think, is a really, really crucial. And I think the other one is also one of the things that we've alluded to earlier, is that we need to believe the victims of domestic violence, that Nicole Brown Simpson needed to be listened to in the years prior to her death, and that had we listened to her, she may well have been alive now, and that is something that is vitally important for everybody to take into account.
That was Joe Street, Associate Professor in Humanities at Northumbria University, Newcastle. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.